Here's the MySpace trailer premiere of the 11th hour.
The weather and the climate are making news in more than one region.
Severe flooding has killed at least 72 people.
Under siege in the grip of unmitigated catastrophe.
The evidence is now clear. Industrial civilization has caused irreparable damage. Our political and corporate leaders have consistently ignored the overwhelming scientific evidence.
Not only is it the 11th hour, it's 11:59.
What we saw with Katrina is just prologue. Worse is yet to come.
The UN estimates that by the middle of the century, there may be 150 million environmental refugees.
There are too many of us using too many resources too fast.
The problem is that every living system is in decline, and the rate of decline is accelerating.
The tragedy is the potential extinction of humankind.
We face a convergence of crises, all of which are a concern for life. Will our pivotal generation create a sustainable world in time?
People need to realize there are things they can do in their everyday lives. Everybody making a change adds up to something meaningful.
Our project today is the welfare of all of life as a practical objective.
With existing technologies, we could literally reduce the human footprint on planet Earth by 90%.
We have to imagine what it would be like to redesign design itself.
These are not technical issues nearly as much as they are leadership issues. There was a time when Republicans and Democrats joined to pass major environmental laws. 500 years out, people look back at this time that this was our finest hour.
What a great time to be born. What a great time to be alive, because this generation gets to completely change this world.
Is it the 11th hour for the world? Famous actor and now producer Leonardo DiCaprio is releasing his post-Gore documentary this week across North America. I got a sneak preview last night, and you'll hear more about it later in this week's edition of Radio EcoShaw. In the new film, a whole series of experts get to say their piece. You know, instead of the talking heads and fanatics of Fox TV, scientists and real experts who devote their lives to finding answers get a platform to share their concerns with you. Definitely worth watching. Organize a posse and get out there and see the 11th hour. Maybe if this gets a little box office success, people will learn more about reality instead of fantasy games where we always win. Anyway, you don't have to worry about climate change. In fact, you don't have to change a thing. President Bush has got it covered. He's got a plan. Scary words. Every time Bush gets into action, a lot of innocent people die while his cronies get rich. This time, it's the biofuels bonanza. In just a minute, our guest from Germany, economist F. William Engdahl, says biofuels are the next big fraud. Then we'll find out that all that new corn and plenty of other items on your grocery table were genetically twisted in the lab. 3/4 of North Americans want genetically modified food to be labeled because they don't want to eat it. Josh Brandon of Greenpeace will explain why a crop circle warning appeared in Vancouver just recently, and what are they trying to tell us? Finally, we have Living Oceans campaigner Catherine Stewart back from Norway, the headquarters of the world's largest fish farming companies. Salmon on the West Coast are threatened and dying off. The mighty Fraser River run is so poor this year, the entire commercial fishery was cancelled. Meanwhile, the government just keeps announcing more and more fish farms, even though the science is already in. Fish farms breed the sea lice that kill off wild salmon. There is some good news, though. Finally, a trial farm will use closed containment. All that coming up. Incidentally, this show and our features are rebroadcast on a number of stations in Canada, the United States, and even sometimes Australia. Last Monday, KPFK, the Pacifica Network station in Los Angeles, rebroadcast our interview with Gregory Green, the director of Escape from Suburbia. Here's a clip. We've been speaking with Gregory Green, the director of the new film Escape from Suburbia. Gregory, thanks so much for taking the time for talking with us today.
Thanks very much.
That was Canadian filmmaker Gregory Green, whose film, Escape from Suburbia, was just released on DVD. He spoke with Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock News in Vancouver, British Columbia. To find out more, including links for how you can get your own copy of the video, visit our website at kpfk.org and click over to the program link for today's edition of Indie Media On Air. This is KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
That was an important show about peak oil, climate change, and the way we live. You can download all our past shows from the website for free at www.ecoshock.org. And since I don't claim any copyright on my work, feel free to download EcoShock shows and interviews, burn them to your CD player, pass them on as widely as possible. Let's get the word out while we still have a little time to change our polluting ways. It's the 11th hour, my friends, not the end times. Well, not yet. I'm your host, Alex Smith, and let's go to our feature interview with the widely published energy watcher, F. William Engdahl.
America is addicted to oil.
When President George Bush says he's got a plan to solve something, you know things aren't going to turn out well. In his January State of the Union address, Bush mouthed the usual platitudes, we thought, about oil independence and even cutting greenhouse gas emissions. Now an experienced world watcher and economist, F. William Engdahl, says Bush's plans for biofuels are real, and in the long run, could be as stupid and deadly as his invasion of Iraq. We have Mr. Engdahl on the line from his home in Germany. Now, you've created a lot of waves with an article published in Asia Times and then republished all over the place, including in Counterpunch on August 13th. It's titled, Buy Feed Corn, They're About to Stop Making It, The Hidden Agenda Behind Bush's Biofuel Plan. For those who like to Google along as they listen, Engdahl is spelled E-N-G-D-A-H-L, and you can find the article at counterpunch.org. Mr. Engdahl, what did Bush announce, and is this a serious move by the United States?
Unfortunately, Alex, it's quite serious. In his January State of the Union address, the president called for 20 in 10, as he called it, cutting U.S. gasoline use by 20% by the year 2010. Officially, to reduce dependency on imported oil and to cut unwanted greenhouse gas emissions. Well, when George W. Bush starts getting sentimental and morally concerned about greenhouse gas emissions, we can perk up our ears and say, what else is going on here?
Well, one thing that's going on, you mentioned that U.S. producers are getting a hefty government subsidy of 51 cents for every gallon of ethanol they make. Who's profiting from that taxpayer windfall?
Well, I think the whole push that's taken place in the last 3 years as oil prices rose up to high 60s and into $70 a barrel for Brent crude on the world market. The push for this has come from the agribusiness multinationals like Archer Daniel Midland, Cargill Corporation. These are largely global companies who more or less control the price of food on the consumer table worldwide. That's something that most people don't appreciate.
Well, I guess Brazil is held up as the model of a country that practically runs on ethanol. Couldn't that work in North America, too?
Brazil has a very specific problem. Brazil's ethanol policy, to my mind, is insane. They should be spending the money from the state drilling for oil offshore and onshore, which I'm sure is there in abundance, and other less environmentally damaging resources. But the problem with Brazil, all their cars have so-called flexi-fuel engines that can burn gasoline or biofuel, depending on the daily prices. But Brazil is also a major exporter of biofuel. The problem is ordinary Brazilian peasants and people in depressed rural areas don't have enough adequate protein and food in their diet. And the Brazilian government is encouraging farmers to grow corn to burn it for fuel, which is, to my mind, the criminal aspect about this whole biofuels fraud.
And meanwhile, there's a sort of new free trade agreement developing for ethanol fuels in the Western Hemisphere. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Bush is talking with President Lula about an ethanol pact to cooperate in research and development of next-generation biofuel technologies such as cellulosic ethanol, which could be taken from wood. The last thing in the world Brazil needs to do is have an incentive to plow down more of the rainforest in the Amazon for agriculture or agribusiness uses. That's having a catastrophic effect on the global climate patterns, and now they're talking about providing state tax incentives in Brazil for taking ethanol from wood, so the denuding of the forest will just get a real turbocharge from that.
I know all of this is being sold to us as a great green step forward, but you doubt that. Why?
Well, I don't think the science backs it up. A green step forward, the emissions of ethanol are not at all benign. It has toxins including formaldehyde, acetaldehyde, a suspected neurotoxin, which is even banned in California as a carcinogenic. And it requires special seals in the engine. It's highly corrosive to pipelines and fuel systems of existing cars, special new gas pumps. All this conversion costs a lot of money. And the real killer about ethanol is that it's a net energy loser. It has at least 30% less energy per gallon than normal gasoline, something that rarely is said by the advocates of ethanol. They go on a lot of vague promises or simply bad subsidized science from university departments that get money from British Petroleum or ExxonMobil to do wonderful independent tests that show ethanol is a great gain, but it just doesn't bear out. I know indirectly someone who's involved with one of the most successful ethanol producing companies in California, and privately he says this is nothing but a political fraud, a hoax on consumers, and I think that's the real point about ethanol. But the danger is we're taking land, precious land. I mean, the water use of ethanol, if you want to look at ecological consequences, California, for example, is a state that has drastically limited resources of water for growing something like, I think, 50% of the nation's vegetables, fresh fruits, nuts, and so forth. And they do that through very, very expensive irrigation. And growing food for fuel, corn ethanol takes between 4 to 5 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of ethanol just to manufacture, and to say nothing of the water needed to grow the corn in the first place. So this is lunacy beyond belief what we're doing.
And I guess the big question for a lot of people concerned about climate change is, will this switch to ethanol really reduce our greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, MIT did a recent study and concluded that corn ethanol replacing gasoline would have no impact on greenhouse gas emissions, would expand fossil fuel use, gasoline, normal gasoline use, because of increased demand for fertilizer and irrigation, simply to increase the acreage of ethanol crops. MIT makes a claim that natural gas consumption is something like 66% of total corn ethanol production energy. So you have huge new strains on natural gas supply, and that will also push energy costs higher in the U.S.
So we're not really adding up the total real costs of producing a gallon of ethanol.
Well, that's the thing that the consumer fraud in this whole pitch by the administration and by the ethanol industry. This is huge, huge explosive growth that's taken place since 2005. It's estimated by 2008, that is next harvest season, 50% of all corn grown in the United States will be for bioethanol. That is staggering. And, I mean, this is growing at a rate of something like 300% increase in acreage in the last 2 years. So with that kind of an explosive growth, it's having a catastrophic effect on food prices on the table. The farmers just aren't getting reasonably priced corn. Corn is mainly grown for a cattle and animal feed source, and along with soybeans. Both of them now are being converted into biofuels. And that means the corn isn't there to feed the cattle, therefore the prices of meat on the grocery shelf are exploding. The price of corn itself at the consumer level has doubled since last September. And we're just at the beginning of this, so this is going to have a massive impact for the poorest segment of the world population on their daily cost of food.
So it could be that people may starve to death in a far-flung corner of the world, and even the poor in North America will be severely impacted just to keep pumping fuel into gas-guzzling SUVs and keep the suburbs going the way they've been going. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that certainly is one of the consequences. I think there's a much deeper, more ominous agenda. I've just finished a book which is about to be published by Global Research in Canada, end of September, beginning October, called The Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation. And the whole agenda of GMO foods, Terminator seeds and so forth, Monsanto, Syngenta, DuPont, Dow Chemical, is control of the seed supply of the planet. And if you give three or four private companies that throw in Cargill and ADM with the ethanol, that kind of control over the food chain, you have the potential for a dictatorship over the quality of life on this planet that never in history has been possible. That, frankly, scares me. I don't care if, you had a saint as the chairman of the board of Monsanto, which I don't think anyone would argue that we do.
So kind of a possibility of a food dictatorship, and it would be directly linked to energy through this biofuel.
Exactly. The price of food now is getting very much linked because of biofuels. The basic feed grains are the main commodities and food that are traded on the Chicago Exchange and so forth. And those prices are being linked to gasoline prices for the first time ever. And that's pretty scary, with the gasoline prices tipping $70-$75 a barrel, and who knows, the next stop could be $80, $95, $100 as the demand out of China and India continues to explode at double-digit annual rates.
I know. I've heard Lester Brown, the founder of World Watch, has been warning about this same thing, and also that it's happening at a time when our world grain stocks and our food supplies that we all count on in case things don't go well are dwindling down.
Well, this is the alarming thing, that this legislation was passed by the Congress of the United States in 2005, and the Congress of the United States has resources in terms of intelligence, in terms of information from the U.S. Department of Agriculture on world cereal carryover stocks. You can do a mouse click on Google, go in the Internet under FAO and get the official data on this. And it's the case that six of the last 7 years, the world carryover stocks of grains, that means rice, wheat, corn, and so forth, the total carryover stocks, the emergency reserve that we have for a drought or a famine or some emergency, have gone down six of the last 7 years, and we now have carryover stocks that are something like a 20-year low. That is alarming. And in that climate, I mean, it is as though you pre-programmed, getting a royal flush in Las Vegas and betting $1 billion on the table. It was so clear that the price of ordinary foodstuffs was going to explode through the roof with this kind of situation. And now, you know, we're just exponentially increasing the amount of food we're growing to burn for gasoline, and that's insane. That's insane.
You'd think the big oil companies would be fighting off this competition. After all, biofuels might replace their core products, oil and natural gas. But the big companies, as you say, like ExxonMobil and BP, are running full-page ads touting their new commitment to these so-called green fuels. How come?
Well, it has a double-fold effect for them. One, it makes them into the good guys as far as the environmentally concerned portion of the population. Number two, they want to get in on the scam. There are huge profits to be gained in this, and they want to corner energy in all forms and create one global conglomerate of energy, period. BP last year, some of you may have read, announced a $500 million grant to the University of California, Berkeley, and Lawrence Livermore. Why? In order to fund a R&D into alternative energy, including biofuels. And the terms of that grant were that British Petroleum will dictate to California Berkeley, UC Berkeley, exactly what the research would be and would have proprietary rights on all results. So, you know, what is that for university freedom and independent science? Stanford has a global climate energy program. They got $100 million from ExxonMobil. UC Davis got $25 million from Chevron for bioenergy research. Princeton University Carbon Mitigation Initiative got $15 million from British Petroleum. So they are big into this. They want to be on the ground floor to control and steer this thing to meld it with their control over the global energy markets in oil and natural gas.
Because they'll make money feeding all those tractors and making the fertilizers
sure.
out of oil and natural gas. And just in a thousand ways, they'll keep on making money even as biofuels develop.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, I think that Bush and the oil companies can get away with the biofuel scam because we all want to keep the illusion of driving gas-guzzling cars forever. We're part of this conspiracy in a way. You've written about extensively about peak oil and geopolitics. Do you think the big companies are just feeding our complacency, our fear of the coming changes to our lifestyle?
Alex, can you spell that out a little bit, flesh that out a little bit?
Well, is it? Are they able to do this because we as consumers don't want to change our lifestyle, that we want oil and natural gas to keep on coming forever? So if they can make this substitute, even if it doesn't work, we'll go along with it so long as we don't have to move out of suburbia or give up our SUV.
Well, nobody likes to have drastic lifestyle changes. I think that's human. But the problem is the American consuming public has been hooked on these ghastly SUVs and gas guzzlers of various sorts. In Europe, the average European is shocked at the per capita fuel consumption of the American public because they, back during the 70s when the first oil shock hit, or first oil shocks hit, the European car industry shifted to fuel-efficient diesel motors and developed very, very refined diesel that gets something like double the gas mileage of an average American gas guzzler. So they're much more conservative on energy conservation and using the resources more sensibly. The whole question of peak oil, that's a much more complicated question. I think, frankly, and I may offend some of your listeners, but I think peak oil, and I've researched this question as I have a few questions in several decades of covering the energy industry as a researcher. I think the peak oil question is a scam that is covertly being financed by big oil. Simply that people say, well, what can we do? We're running out of oil, so $75 a barrel, $30 a barrel 4 years ago, that's fate. We have to learn to live with it. That's a whole other issue. It's a geopolitical issue, and it requires, to my mind, a separate program to really give justice to what I think on that question. But in terms of pushing ethanol on consumers to give them, lull them into a feeling of false security, I think that's very much part of the attraction.
Well, I'd like to do a program with you at some point on your new book on genetically modified crops. Will you let me know when that comes out?
Great. I'd love to do it.
Well, this is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and we've been talking with F. William Engdahl, the author of A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, and now an upcoming book, Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation. Can you give us a website where we can find out more of your work?
It's www.engdahl.oilgeopolitics.net.
Very good. Well, that was F. William Engdahl, and this is Radio EcoShock. Find us on the web at ecoshock.org. Thanks for talking a lot with us today.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. We've just heard how corn is being planted all over due to government subsidies for biofuels, but it isn't even real corn. Most of those crops are bioengineered by a couple of big chemical companies. Should we care if it just goes into the gas tank? Well, yes indeed. For one thing, GE food is hitting your plate every day, whether you know it or not. It's all mixed in together. But as Josh Brandon of Greenpeace tells us, there's lots of other worries. GE corn uses tons of herbicides, wrecks the soil, and impacts all kinds of insects and soil life. Recently, Even the aliens objected, leaving a big question mark in a crop circle deep in a GE cornfield in British Columbia.
Well, you know, I don't believe in aliens making crop circles, but maybe I should. The Vancouver Sun had a photo of a very strange crop circle appearing in a field just outside of the city. I have Josh Brandon of Greenpeace on the line. Josh, can you tell us about this mysterious event?
Well, it's not quite so mysterious, but it is a bit alarming. Greenpeace made a 61-meter crop circle in a farm growing genetically engineered corn just east of Abbotsford. And we did this action to draw attention to the fact that Canada is one of a shrinking number of countries worldwide without mandatory GE labeling, and as well to raise a number of questions about the uncertainties around GE corn.
Can you describe what the actual symbol looked like for our listeners?
Sure, yeah. What it was a question mark with a circle around it. And, like I said, this highlights a number of questions because there's a growing amount of uncertainty about how safe GE corn is, as well as all types of genetically engineered organisms that are in our food system right now.
You know, the frustrating thing for a lot of people, nobody ever asked us if we wanted scientists somewhere to change our basic food in a commercial lab. I wouldn't vote for that. It seems like anybody in a lab coat, if they're backed by a corporate board, can just change things like corn or potatoes, maybe forever. Why doesn't our government do something about this?
Well, that's a really good question, because we know that the public doesn't want this in their food supply. 79% want GE food labeled, and in other countries where genetically engineered food has been labeled, we've seen the market for it collapse, and that's why the biotech companies don't want it in their don't want mandatory labeling and want to keep promoting this stuff because it's very profitable for them. But just what the interest of the government is, it's a little less clear, except to say that government does invest a lot of money in promoting these genetically engineered companies, genetically engineered products rather, and as well receives a lot of support from the biotech industry. So there's a little bit of money going from hand to hand, and that probably smooths along the authorization of these potentially dangerous products. But what the Royal Society of Canada report back in 2001 said was that the process for approving these products is far from scientific, and in fact what ends up happening is it's the government, it's the industry rather, that is doing their own analyses of crops, whether they're safe or not, and that's what we've seen here with the genetically engineered corn. And I submitted a report last week to the BC Conversation on Health talking about some of the problems with genetically engineered corn that's grown here in British Columbia.
Well, it's just being tested out on us, really. We'll find out 10, 20 years from now if there's a problem. Shouldn't it have been tested for a long time before it entered our food chain?
Exactly. You know, we've seen time after time industries put forward these products like DDT and said that they're safe, and it's only decades later that the real problem starts showing up in human populations. But you know, we're already seeing the warning signs now, and that's why we felt that we should take a precautionary approach before, you know, letting this food into the food system and also into the environment, because it's not just how it affects people, it's also how it affects biodiversity and how it contaminates other crops, and also we don't know what its effects are on other organisms like insects that are perhaps eating the pollen or eating the crops.
And we do have some organic farmers around the city in the Fraser Valley. Mm-hmm. Are they going to be impacted by somebody planting a genetic crop right next door to them?
They certainly could be. The field where we did this action was within several kilometers as the bee flies of organic farms. So there's definitely a possibility of contamination, and if that happens, we've seen, for example, in Saskatchewan, canola farmers, organic canola farmers, had their industry wiped out by genetic engineering. And I'd say certainly hate to see the same happen here in Vancouver and in Fraser Valley. because it's the fastest growing industry in terms of agriculture here in British Columbia. And it's also the only way now that we have to avoid GE and genetically engineered foods.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the day when it's on the labels. I mean, I do read labels just for my own health. I'm looking for trans fats and other things, but I can't tell whether it's GE or not.
No, you can't tell unless it's organic. Organic food, it is labeled, and so it gives people one option, but even there, because of the dangers of contamination, you never know. So long as there is genetically engineered food in the food system, there's always the possibility of contamination. So really, there isn't any real possibility of coexistence between genetic engineered crops and non-genetically engineered crops.
Well, I know there's a worldwide movement of resistance to sort of corporate pollution of our food. Can you give us a few ideas of what is going on in other countries?
Well, we've seen there's over 4,000 genetically engineered free zones around the world. Hmm. That's when farmers locally agree that their region isn't going to produce any GE crops. And we've got a couple of examples of that here in British Columbia. Powell River on the Sunshine Coast and the Gulf Islands as well, and other farmers out in the Kootenays and up in the Yukon are working on the same kind of movement. But in Europe, it's much bigger. For example, in Ireland, they're moving county by county, so pretty soon the whole country there is going to be GE-free. In India, there's been some really great movements by farmers there. They have huge protests against genetic engineering there, and some really great photo examples you could see on the Greenpeace website, for example, if you're interested in seeing some of that.
What's the actual website people should go to?
Well, you can check out to see the pictures of the crop circle action that Greenpeace just did. You can check out www.greenpeace.ca/cropcircle. And that'll take you right to the photo and action that we did. But the Greenpeace, www.greenpeace.org, has some other international examples if you want to see what's happening internationally around the world about GE.
Do you get a sense that people, now that they're getting better informed about this issue, want to become more involved, want to get active somehow?
For sure. We see a growing grassroots movement here in BC. There's a local group here, GE Free BC, that has hundreds of supporters already. And it's a movement that's going on right across the country. And here BC is one of the hotbeds for that movement. So it's where we're going to see the most action. That's why we're calling on the BC government to take action. Because the federal government doesn't seem to want to move on this issue, and we think that British Columbians, especially with the Olympics coming, it's a great opportunity for Gordon Campbell to make some movement on GE and give us mandatory labeling, because for British Columbians it is an election issue, and Greenpeace has a petition for mandatory labeling before 2009, which is the next provincial election. And you can download copies of that petition from the Greenpeace website that I gave you the address earlier, greenpeace.ca, GE petition. So www.greenpeace.ca/GE petition.
Well, I think people should at least get their names on there and look for it when the next election comes along. In the meantime, maybe put a little pressure on their food retailers saying, we want to know, we want some labeling. I mean, if people go to their Safeway or Save-On or whatever and just start talking to the manager there or the produce manager or whoever and say, we want to know whether this is GE or not, and we don't want genetically engineered food.
That's a really great thing that individuals can do, and it does have impact. You know, we've seen time after time when people let their retailers know, that puts pressure on the retailers to give them those opportunities and those choices.
Is there anything else you want to tell our listeners?
Well, you know, just wanted to mention a couple of things about the corn in particular that's grown here in BC, because a lot of people don't know that genetically engineered corn is grown in BC, and we know now that almost half of the corn that is grown here in BC is genetically engineered. As much as 6,000 hectares of it is grown, and it's really a scary thing because there's been tests done in on rats showing that that it's toxic. And one of the things we found was that there's signs of toxicity in the liver and kidneys of rats that went through the feeding trials. So it's really stuff that we should be avoiding, and so it's time now to put pressure on government to give us mandatory labeling.
So I like to get to what we call Chilliwack corn, which is basically just corn from the valley, local corn. I wonder if there's a way to track back to the grower, you know, when you're buying at a local little stand even, and just, again, say, boy, I hope this isn't genetically engineered, because if I find out it is, I'm not going to be buying from you next year.
Well, you know, go to the farmers markets, and the people that participate at those are almost all very reputable farmers, and it's a great way of, you know, bringing in that personal contact so that there isn't this strange mediation between the producer and the consumer. Brings you directly into contact so you can ask those sorts of questions. And what you'll find is the farmers that are selling at these markets go way beyond out of their way to make sure that there isn't genetic contamination of their crops.
And that way we could sort of support the good people who are trying to farm, well, as nature intended, we could say.
Exactly. And this, nothing about what we did in our action was meant to hurt farmers in any way. We have nothing but respect for the people who are doing the hard work of producing food. The problem is that there's corporations out there that have taken control over much of the seed supply, and that the government isn't doing anything to regulate that.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and we've been talking with Josh Brandon, a genetic engineering campaigner for Greenpeace in Canada. And I really appreciate the information you've given us today, Josh.
Thanks very much, Alex.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Download that interview and pass it around from our website, ecoshock.org. Just look for the radio show link on the main page. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, the flagship station for Radio EcoShock, blasting out of Vancouver, Canada every Friday at 1 p.m. Hear it on the net at www.cooperadio.org/listen. You know, a lot of important people like to catch their own salmon. The most important are the First Nations peoples who have been depending on the salmon catch for the last 10,000 years. And aside from the many other BC residents who angle for salmon and the commercial fishing fleet, we have famous celebrities who fly in from all over the world just for the chance of landing a big sockeye. BC exports a lot of salmon as a delicacy, but sadly, more and more is coming from aquaculture, the giant pens floating at the mouths of our best rivers. These pens of Atlantic salmon breed the sea lice that infect and kill off the treasury of wild salmon we inherited. A coalition of groups called CAR went to the headquarters of the big salmon industry in Norway last June, and since then, the Canadian federal government has announced funding for a possible solution, closed containment pens. There's a lot of salmon news, and right at the heart of it, as always, is Catherine Stewart, one of the most experienced environmental campaigners in Canada. Let's talk to her now. I'm really pleased to have back in the studio today Catherine Stewart of Living Oceans Society, and we should get an update on what's been going on with the sea lice problem and the salmon off the coast of British Columbia, and the whole problem of salmon farming, whether it really is endangering our wild stock. So, Catherine, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you were in Norway in June, I gather?
Yes, that's correct. I was part of a delegation that went from British Columbia, from Chile, which is one of the world's, well, the world's largest salmon farm producer, and from the Pure Salmon Campaign in the United States, which also has representatives in Scotland and does work in Ireland as well, other fish farming jurisdictions.
So there are people around the world who are concerned about this problem. Who went from British Columbia?
Myself and Brian Gunn, who's the president of the Wilderness Tourism Association, and Chief Bob Chamberlain of the Kwiksutanik First Nation in the Broughton Archipelago.
So the Broughton seems to be the focus of this. What were you doing over in Norway?
We were there for the annual general meeting and shareholder meeting of Marine Harvest, which is the largest salmon farming company in the world. And we presented before the board, the chief executives and the shareholders, stating the case about how their fish farms that are placed on the migratory routes of wild salmon are harming our wild salmon, and appealing to the board to change their practices. It's a threat to the salmon, and the salmon are the backbone of the culture and traditions of the First Nations in British Columbia's coast. It's also a threat to businesses that depend on nature and a healthy natural world, which is why Mr. Gunn, the president of the Wilderness Tourism Association, joined us.
Yes, I guess a lot of people, whether they're rich or middle class, want to go and fish the wild salmon, and of course also the Aboriginal people have been depending on them for thousands of years, and we know that the forest also depends on the wild salmon. So what kind of response does the Norwegian government have to all this?
Well, the Norwegian government is actually starting to try and tackle the problem. Unlike Canada's federal and provincial governments, they've recognized that the weight of scientific evidence internationally is clear, that fish farms breed sea lice kill wild salmon, and something has to be done to address the problem. In fact, in British Columbia, the problem is even worse because our juvenile salmon are much smaller than the wild Atlantic salmon when the Atlantics emerge from their freshwater streams. So we have an exacerbated problem and a government completely unwilling to address it. In Norway, they are in the process of declaring areas as national salmon rivers, recognizing that the wild stocks are really important and they must be afforded some degree of protection from the fish farms. Two fjords in Norway have been declared completely fish farm free, and all of the open net cage pens have to move out of those fjords in their entirety. And 51 in total have been identified as national salmon rivers where the fish farms are being forced out the length of the fjord to the outer edges where it emerges into the ocean, the theory being that the juvenile salmon will be slightly larger by the time they reach the farms and better able to withstand the sea lice infestations.
Do you see these sorts of things happening in British Columbia in the future?
No, and that was part of the message that we were delivering to Norway and to the Norwegian corporations that operate in BC. 90% of the fish farms in British Columbia are controlled by three Norwegian companies, Marine Harvest, Grieg Seafoods, and Cermaq, or Mainstream. And the companies are practicing in British Columbia in ways that they can no longer run their businesses in Norway, but they can get away with it here, and so they continue to do so. We wanted to let the Norwegian citizens and the Norwegian government, which is a major shareholder in Cermaq, know that these companies are, you know, exploiting BC's wilderness and threatening our wild salmon stocks.
What were the Chilean representatives having to say?
Well, the Chilean representatives, one was from the Pure Salmon Campaign, which is affiliated with National Environment Trust, and they're concerned about the ecological impacts of the absolute explosion of salmon farms in Chile. And there was also a representative from the Salmon Farmers and Fishermen's Workers Association. I believe there have been 18 deaths in the last 2 years associated with salmon farm production in Chile. Divers are dying when they're checking the nets. There's just very poor work conditions, very poor labor rights, which is, I suppose, not surprising. But again, the Norwegian companies are taking advantage of lax labor laws and standards in a foreign country, and from the workers' perspective, exploiting the workers, not caring for their health and safety.
But we have possibly a more positive direction coming here in British Columbia with this idea of closed containment farming. Can you tell us what's going on with that?
Absolutely. The Living Oceans and the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform have been calling for years for a transition to closed containment. And recently, the provincial governments appointed special committee on sustainable aquaculture came to the same conclusions. The majority report recommended a transition transition over the next 5 years for all open net cage fish farms into closed containment technology. The fish farming industry and its supporters are claiming that it's unproven, untested, untried, it can't be done. But in fact, it can be. And in fact, there was a very successful land-based operation of closed tank fish farming that raised a very good product, raised the salmon in the tanks. The problem was the expense. Economically, because it was land-based and there was a great deal of cost associated with pumping the water up to the land-based facility, it was cost prohibitive. The same entrepreneur who developed that facility is now looking at a floating tank system that would be placed in the ocean with impermeable barriers around the tanks, preventing sea lice escaping from the farm, preventing predator interactions with the farm, etc. And in a huge leap forward, in July, a federal not-for-profit corporation that was created by the Government of Canada called Sustainable Development Technology Canada announced that after rigorous due diligence, they had concluded this was a very worthwhile proposal, and they awarded the Middle Bay Sustainable Aquaculture Institute $2.4 million to start building the first floating closed-contained tanks.
So we might be able to have a project here that would show a way out for the rest of the world where we could have farmed fish, but we wouldn't have all the damage to the wild stocks. Is that the idea behind this?
Damage to the wild stocks, damage to the benthic environment, the ocean bottom, you know, threats to seals and sea lions, all of the problems associated with open net cage fish farming could quite probably be effectively addressed by closed containment. We believe, and the proponents behind the agri-marine project believe, that it can be done in an economically viable way as well. So the plan at this point is for a pilot project with four tanks, commercial scale, to be in the water. The first fish should be going in this winter. And the CAR, the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform, is part of a multi-stakeholder monitoring body that will be looking at the environmental performance of the project as well as the economic performance.
How can people find out more about CAR and about your own organization?
Well, you can go to our website, which is livingoceans.org. You can check out the coalition website, farmedanddangerous.org. And you can also look at the Middle Bay Project under sustainable-aquaculture.com, I believe. Anyway, search for agri-marine or Middle Bay Sustainable Aquaculture, and you can learn more about the closed tank technology as well.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell us?
Just that we are extremely concerned at the provincial government's continued intransigence on this issue. After the committee's report, the provincially appointed committee's report was released recommending a transition to closed containment, the government said they would have a response within a month or two. It's been several months now, and their only response has been to approve three more open net cage farms on the BC coast, one on the west coast of Vancouver Island near Nootka Sound, and two more on the central coast, the central mainland coast of BC. We're extremely concerned by this. We feel that the evidence, the scientific evidence to date, the weight of public opinion in British Columbia, all the forces are indicating that the government should at the very least stop approving any more open net cage farms that are threatening the health of our oceans and the survival of our wild salmon stocks, in particular our pink and chum salmon. Unfortunately, instead of matching the federal government's contribution to developing closed containment, all the government has done so far is keep issuing new licenses for more open net cage farms.
Just keep printing up those licenses and throwing out more dangerous farmed salmon, and instead of investing in the solutions to it. I'm hoping there will be a reversal in that. I presume that you have some pressure on the government and some connections with the government to try and bring them around to a new future for salmon farming.
We absolutely do, and we're in ongoing dialogue with the minister responsible, with his deputy, and with other staff in the department in the Ministry of Agriculture, which is responsible for fish farming in BC. We hope that when the government reconvenes in the fall and cabinet is able to discuss these issues in depth, that there will be a budget allocation and that the government will contribute to and invest in this solution. We're optimistic, and Living Oceans and our allies in CAR are going to keep pushing for that. But in the meantime, it's very encouraging to see the federal government support this and to see the fish going into the closed containment tanks sometime this winter. It's a major step forward in BC, and we hope that we can prove the traditional aquaculture industry wrong when they claim that this could never be done.
Thank you so much, Catherine Stewart from the Living Oceans Society.
My pleasure.
Of course, this is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Who else would bring you the hot environmental news? We still have time for a short 3-minute clip right from the fish farm board meeting in Norway. This is Brian Gunn, representing the sports fishing industry and all the tourism people who are bringing people to the wildness of British Columbia. He explains why the industry needs big changes if we want to keep wild salmon at all.
I'm president of the Wilderness Tourism Association of British Columbia. We are a group of owner-operators, small operators, maybe maximum revenue, $4 or $5 million Canadian dollars a year, up to 30, 40 employees. We number about 2,200 businesses and about 16,000 employees and about $1 billion in revenue. So we are the drawing card for tourism in British Columbia. And our operators, half of our operators, are dependent on the coastal wild salmon. And our operators are threatened by the sea lice problem that comes from your farms, principally from Marine Harvest and from Cermaq and Great Farms in Canada. And we have been told that there's research to show that it doesn't, sea lice do not come from the farms. Our operators are out there on a daily basis in the Broughton Archipelago, where there's the most prevalent sea lice, and they see the actual lice arriving on the baby salmon and killing them. When they go at the spawning channel, where the fry come out, there are no sea lice. When they go near the farm, there are sea lice. So we don't need more research. We don't need to hear the BC Farmers Association telling us that it's not scientifically proven. We can see it with our own eyes. And we want you, as the board and as Marine Harvest, to acknowledge openly that sea lice is a major problem, and we want to work with you to solve that problem, because we have the same problems that you do. We're concerned about the future. Our certainty is what really concerns us, and our profitability depends on the future. And your profitability and certainty depend on the future, and depend on what's happening. It depends on good relationships. It depends on solving this problem of sea lice in the Broughton Archipelago. We think that now the problem is so serious that we believe that if something's not done about it, our wild salmon industry will die, and you will be known as the killers. We don't want that to happen. We want to work with you to find a solution. We want to see those farms in the immediate vicinity of the wild fry. We want to see them fallow, or we want to see them moved. And we want you to look seriously at closed containment. There is a closed containment model being built in Campbell River as I speak. The tank has been fabricated. It's 33 meters in diameter and about 8 meters deep. And it will capture all the waste products and treat them. It will guard against predator attacks. And it will go a long ways to solving the sea lice problem. Maybe solve it without treating incoming and outgoing water. We don't know until the work has been done. But we would appreciate your company supporting that initiative, finding out what's going on, and looking seriously at it. We also feel, as I'm an engineer, I'm a can-do person, I listen to the fact the farm's always talking about, oh, closed containment's been tried before, it fails, it's not going to work economically. I believe it can work economically. I know the engineers involved in building it, and it needs a can-do company. I think Marine Harvest can be a can-do company and can make the effort to show that closed containment can be an answer to our problems on the coast of British Columbia. Thank you.
That was Brian Gunn, the president of the Wilderness Tourism Association of British Columbia, speaking on June 28th to the board of Marine Harvest, the mega aquaculture company that does fish farming on several continents. It may be the 11th hour for the wild salmon, and certainly a huge number of species are facing extinction due to human pressures and pollution. Titanic Earth has struck an iceberg, but it's still capable of being saved if we start pumping now. That's the message of film star Leonardo DiCaprio in his new movie, The 11th Hour. It was co-directed by Leela Connor Peterson and Nadia Connor, who have also been appearing on the talk show rounds promoting the movie. Incidentally, while we talk of celebrities, Nadia Connor's maiden name was Nadia Comaneci. That's right, the gymnast who took the 1976 and 80 Olympics by storm, winning lots of gold medals. Even a famous BC environmentalist hit new fame in this new movie. Well-known forest activist Zipporah Berman appears in the film, explaining that the deforestation caused by logging in Canada releases more greenhouse gases than all the cars of California. That sparked a furious debate in the Canadian forest industry, which was just painting itself green, as a solution to climate change. We'll have more on that debate in a future show. Find out for yourself right now by going to forestethics.org. Meanwhile, I got a good laugh finding a photo of Zipporah, not on the front lines of a new protest, but standing for a celeb shot with Paris Hilton. Zipporah looks like she's trying to hold a straight face, but what the hey? We need a few more heiresses and actors donating to hardworking enviro groups like Forest Ethics, Greenpeace, and the Sierra Club. Of course, the TV talk show hosts spend their interview time just ragging on Leonardo DiCaprio, and does he fly around making carbon, and what does he spend on his suits? They never seem to get the time to zoom in on all the experts who are warning us that it is the 11th hour. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock, and thanks for caring about your world. We'll go out with a classic Walk Me Out in the Morning Dew, recorded by Lulu in 1968 or so, and written by the Canadian Bonnie Dobson.
Young man crying at all.